come to you in the name of Jesus, and we ask that you would walk with us tonight. Father, I ask that you would be with us in this book that the world deems too difficult to understand and most churches have laid aside on a dusty shelf. And we ask, Lord, that you would open the treasure of this wonderful writing for us, that we would learn what you would have us to learn and that you would be pleased. God, I ask especially tonight that I would not say or do anything that would not please you. And we offer this as a sacrifice to you. Thank you for people that are willing to study the hard stuff, because you are the God that strengthens. We love you, and in Jesus' name, amen. We are in the book of Ezekiel. If you didn't intend to be here, either turn off the tape or walk out the door, because that's what you're here for tonight. We are going to adventure into one of the apocalyptic books of the Bible that I've got to say is right up there with Revelation. In fact, I'm going to lay it beside Revelations throughout the study, and you're going to see that John may even be quoting Ezekiel in some areas, which I haven't picked up on before. And you're also going to see that he's Isaiah-ish, and that he's a wonderful writer. He's got a grasp of literary style that rivals Isaiah. And he's an actor, and he's a portrayer, and he is a dedicated, godly priest and prophet, and that's who you're going to meet tonight, just beginning. And as we travel, I want you to know there are 48 chapters. Someone asked me, how long is this going to take you? And I said, I estimate 6 months, maybe seven. You know me, I can tend. We're going to take some side trips. We're definitely going to do the Gog Magog a week on itself, and that's the 38th and 39th chapter. We may do the Dry Bones chapter a week or two, because you need to understand what God's saying there about Israel. And you're going to be just amazed, I think, at the sci-fi thriller that's laying before you. The time of Isaiah, there's some really interesting things about this author. He is a chronological writer in that he's going to date things. He's going to tell you on the exact date he did something. I would say he's a journal expert extraordinaire. If you want to talk about a journaler, it's Ezekiel. He's going to tell you, in fact, he starts on July 31st, 595 and 593 BC. We know that. He tells you. And I'm a literalist. I don't have to analyze that to be anything but what it is. We're also going to tell you, and skip ahead just a little bit, because I'm going to give you an overview of the book before I start. When we get to Ezekiel 29, he's going to tell you on March 26th, 571, that prophecy comes to him. We know there's a span of 22 years where he dates and documents, and he spends more time than any other prophet telling about specificity as far as dating. I've never seen anything like it. Now, some of them are logical and they go sequencing, but he wants you to know the exact date. And so I will point that out to you as we study. But tonight, you're going to know when this started. And if you're taking notes, it's July 31st, 593 BC. That's when this started. You want to know how far it was before Jesus? 593 years before Jesus is born. This prophet walks in to Babylonia, Chaldea, whatever you want to call it, Nebuchadnezzar's stomping ground, and begins his mission to prophesy. He is born of a priestly family. He is going to be a priest. Now, I'm going to tell you something interesting. You may have known this. This is an aha moment for me. It's because I've not studied Leviticus and Numbers very much, but it is Levitical that a priest could not start their mission until they were 30. He dates the starting of when he's taken captive at age 25. Let me remind you how important that is. Do you know if someone else really famous 593 years later that would start his mission when he was 30? Because they could not become in their priestly duties until they were 30. Do you ever think why Jesus waited? Because he's following the law. He's a priest. Jesus is a priest. He's a priest. He's a king. That's what you're going to be. And this priest taken captive at age 25 was not yet a priest. So when he's taken captive to Babylon in the second siege of Nebuchadnezzar, first siege happens, Daniel goes. We already know that story. About 12 years later, second siege happens. Nebuchadnezzar comes again. He takes Ezekiel. Ezekiel's 25. He's married. He wasn't practicing his priesthood yet because he was not 30. And there is no longer any need for priests in Babylon because there's no temple. So this priest never gets to be who he's called to be. Never gets to be a priest. He's of that lineage. He's had that training. He's smart enough, and he's of that line. He's from the line of Levi. He's a priest. But he never gets that fulfilled. He will. When he goes into the millennial kingdom, he will. But he's thwarted because when they're taken by Nebuchadnezzar, there's no temple. They are not, they can worship and they can pray to God and all that. They can't sacrifice animals and stuff. They know it's an abomination of God not to do it on the altar that they're supposed to. So he never gets to be a priest. And that's a sad part of this story that I think we have to understand. And also understand that the age 30 was important for Jesus. And that's why Jesus started his ministry at age 30.
Was John Baptist a priest too?
No, okay. He wasn't. That's a good question though. Now the focus of Ezekiel, and there's going to be some focuses and there's going to be some central things, but I want you to know there's no other book in the Bible that talks about the glory of God more than Ezekiel. We've talked about the Shekinah glory before, and some of you weren't familiar with that word, and I will tell you right now, it's not biblical. It's rabbinical. In other words, the rabbis labeled it. It's not in Scripture, but the rabbis knew when the Holy Spirit glory came on the pillars that followed the Israelites in the wilderness, that came into the tabernacle and rested over the Holy of Holies. They called it the Shekinah glory. And this term I want you to get so familiar with because it is Ezekiel that sees it leave the temple. We've talked about that. The Shekinah glory leaves because God's people are taken captive. They have profaned his word. They haven't followed any of the things that they were supposed to. And because God is so distressed with his people, he never goes back on his promise about saying, you're my people and I will never forsake you. But he takes away the promised land from them. You do understand by Nebuchadnezzar taking Judah, the southern kingdom, in the three different stages that he takes them, you do understand he's taking the promised land from them. He took the northern kingdom 120 years before. They were so awful and they had those horrible Baal worship and all that. And you remember that Assyria came in and took them. Remember Sennacherib and all those horrible Assyrians took the northern kingdom never to be out again. The southern kingdom named Judah was allowed about 120 more years because they were not quite as bad, but God got so upset with them. There were some good kings, and I've given you several lists of kings. Josiah was a good king. Hezekiah was a good king. We had some atrocious ones in that, but they got so bad that God said, I'm done with you too. I made a covenant with Abraham that his heritage would be like the stars of heaven, and I will keep that, but I do not have to keep you on the promised land. And when Nebuchadnezzar takes those three sieges, within about 12 years of each year, he takes all of Judea captive, and he lowers Jerusalem to the ground. God said, I took the promised land from you. Because you profane my name. And you're going to find in Ezekiel, he's going to talk more than any other prophet about the glory of God and how it cannot be around unrighteousness. It cannot and it will not be. And if this isn't a warning to America, I want to say, get your nose in Ezekiel. Because God says, you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood. That's what he said to the church. You are a royal priesthood, but what happened to these priests? Took them out of the promised land. Because he will not forsake Israel, and he will not totally destroy Israel, but he took the promised land from them. That's not going to be restored again until they walk with him into the millennial kingdom. People say, oh, no, no, no. In 1948, da-da-da-da, Israel went into the land. No, 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 no. Most Jews do not live in Israel to this day. More Jews live outside Israel than do Israel. Yes, I understand that's symbolic. But the real gathering of the Jews with Jesus will be that march
into the millennium, into the real temple of God, where the Shekinah, which is God Almighty's Son, the Son of God, Son of Man, will be reigning as priest and king for 1,000 years. That's when you're going to see the Shekinah glory restored. It left. We're going to have fun reading when it leaves. In fact, Ezekiel sees it. It goes to the Mount. You want to know where it leaves out of? It leaves over the Mount of Olives. You know when it returns? Jesus walks on earth and it returns. And then it leaves with him. And it'll come back for the millennial temple. That Shekinah glory, most people don't talk about. Ezekiel's going to spend hours talking about the glory of God. I hope we make that a real central point. Now, I'm going to tell you that this was foreseen. I'm going to have Tristan read from King David. I want you all to pull up Psalm 137 because King David saw this story several hundred years before it happened.
By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps on the willows in the midst thereof. For there that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forgot thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy. Remember, O Lord, the children of Edom in the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it, even to the foundation thereof. O daughter of Babylon, who art to be destroyed, happy shall he be that rewardeth thee that thou hast served us. Happy shall ye be that taketh and dasheth the little ones against the stone.
And that's a reference to when they were finally taken captive. The Edomites, which are Esau, remember? Jacob, Esau. Esau, they were cheering on the side, and if they could find a Jewish baby that got dispatched from its parents, they would take them by the feet, and they would slam them against the rocks, and they were cheering and laughing. And King David saw it, and God holds them accountable. We're going to deal with Edom in this reference in Ezekiel 2. There are 13 different passages in this one book about the Shekinah glory of God. And he describes it leaving the temple, not to return until the Messiah appears, and we know when that is. There is also in his writing a particular emphasis on the character of God. We don't hear any messages about this, and I want you to know this so that you can share this with everyone you know. His name is not to be profaned, and you are not to take his laws for granted. There are 10 distinct passages Ezekiel's going to hammer that home. And he's going to say there are consequences to actions. Don't hear that much either, do we? Ezekiel dates everything, so you're not going to be in a cloud on his timeline. You know that. We're going to know he was 25 when he was taken captive. He was 30 when he became a prophet. He was supposed to become a priest then. He's captive in Chaldea, in Babylon. Can't be a priest, so God makes him a prophet. Love it. In chapter 33, just a little side view, he begins prophesying several years before that Jerusalem's going to fall. Everybody's kind of making fun of him, saying, oh no, we've heard messages, Jerusalem's still gone. Because remember, he was taken in the second siege, second captivity, and Jerusalem was still going. He begins telling you, no, it's going to fall. They're going to take us all captive, and everybody's making fun of him. But guess what? In chapter 33... he gets a runner, comes in and says, Jerusalem has fallen, Jerusalem has fallen, and it vindicates everything he said. He is a contemporary of some famous people you may know. You may have heard of Jeremiah. Jeremiah was, let me tell you about the three prophets that are going to hang around this time period, because I think it's important to know historically. Daniel is taken in the first siege by Nebuchadnezzar, and he's already down in Babylon. Remember, he's next to the king. He always was there. The second siege, about 12 years later, Ezekiel's taken, but he's not taken down to clear into Babylon. He's not taken clear down to the capital city. He's taken up close to Tel Aviv. You ever been to Israel? It's northern, a little bit further up. And he's by a big reservoir where most of the captives are taken because they're doing lots of work around there. They're workers. This is where Ezekiel's taken. So he's not close enough proximity that he probably doesn't know Daniel. He knows of him because there's runners back and forth. He may never have met Daniel, but he knows of him because he mentions him at least three times as a hero in his book. I think writings were going back and forth between messengers. And then the third siege, Jerusalem falls, and Jeremiah is still up in that area. He's not taken captive. Jeremiah is ministering to everyone that's left up here in the Jerusalem area. And Ezekiel is in kind of the area of Shebar, which is around that big reservoir. And then further down, another day's journey, is Daniel down with Nebuchadnezzar in the royal palace. These are the three prophets that are all functioning at this time. They're all got a different audience. Each of them are speaking to different audiences at the same time, telling the same story in their own way. You're never going to find any other author, prophet, or writer in the Bible that does more demonstrative things than Ezekiel. He is like a play actor. He's a charade runner. He does almost like Lego building. It's crazy the stuff he does. And what he's dealing with is a particular group of people that God knows what speaks to them. It's really cool. You're going to love this. Just some dates on that to put it in, because I believe you've got to figure out. Now, remember, we're going backwards because we're in B.C. 605, Daniel's taken. That's the first siege. We've studied it. You know the story. Young man, probably early teens. The first group taken were the royals, Daniel's of royal blood. Daniel's from the line of the king. The second siege, this is Ezekiel's number, 597, so it's about 8-9 years. And Ezekiel's taken in 597. We know this because this is all dated historically. Then in 586, which is going to be another 10-11 years, happen, and Jerusalem falls. This is where Jeremiah is honing in his skills up around the Jerusalem area. Different prophecies, same theme. I gave you a list of the kings of Judah. There are some things you should know. The Jehoiakim that they're going to refer to a lot, and I just went back and forth with that because some people say Jehoiakim, some say Jehoiachim. It's the same guy. And I don't know why that's so. You might make a note because I struggle with that this week, thinking, oh, he said Kim, he said Jim, he said Kim. They're the same man. And you're going to know that he has a son, Jehoiachin, and who only lasts 3 months. That's a different story. But so I'm going to be referring to Jehoiakim. Other people call him Chim, C-H-I-M or Cam, same guy. So you know that. We're going to find that this prophet uses parables. He's going to act out truths. He's going to be a play actor. He's going to do impromptu scenes. And he is one of the three prophets who spoke when he was outside of the land. Remember, I told you, Jeremiah is not outside the land. He's still in Jerusalem. That's not him. But guess who the other two are? Daniel. We already talked about him. And you know the other prophet that did a big bunch of writing out? It's John. So he's in the category of some really great heroes. So it's Ezekiel, Daniel, and John do prophetic speakings outside the land, and they are apocryphal in nature. They're all futuristic, and we still talk about all of them today. I'm not saying Jeremiah is not wonderful, but he was not outside the land. He was around the Jerusalem area. Just so you get, I think I have to have this straight in my mind so I understand the place and time, but he's a contemporary of Daniel and Jeremiah. Although we're not sure they ever met. We're not sure they are. We do know there was writings that went back and forth because Daniel refers to that. Now, the first vision is going to be really cool. His name, and I believe names in Hebrew mean a lot. His name means God strengthens. Well, he had to. He took him out of captivity. He's 25. You're going to find in his story he loses his wife. Young man loses his wife, and God tells him, you're not going to weep over her. Just go on. Wow. And that's a whole nother lesson, and we'll dig that apart. And I mean, the tough things God tells this young man. And what I find in studying, he was faithful. He's going to be another hero of my faith. When I get to heaven, I don't know. I'm glad I bought millions of years because I've got so many people I want to meet and just treasure. He's going to be one of them. I hope you fall in love with him like you did Daniel and like you did John and like you did Hosea and Joel and Amos, and I could go Nehemiah. But this guy is a real treasure, and his name means God strengthens. He was trained as a priest, and I will prove to you that there was no other prophet, not even the professional priests, that were as intense as far as knowing what they knew. He was well trained in the priesthood. He was from a family of priests. And many people compare him to the caliber of a high priest. I don't know that. He never got to do that. There is no stranger book in the Bible than the book of Ezekiel. It may even rival Revelation. Not sure about that. He becomes paralyzed at one point. He's bound and dumb for 7 days. He eats scrolls, excrement. His hair and beard are cut off by a sharp sword that he divides into three separate sections and burns them all over the city. He flees from Babylon, and he actually flies. Are you interested yet in studying him? He writes of gruesome and bloody events. People die when he looks at them. And he resurrects people from the dead. He is the only prophet to be transported visionary, apparently 4 times. He literally, I'd say, space travels or dimension travels. Are you curious yet? He has bizarre visions. He tastes strange things. The book actually suggests that he's a really good entertainer because audiences flock to him. He has a really dire message to Israel. And this message, I will tell you, this book is written to Israel. This book is written to God's people. Yes, we're going to learn a lot from it. But never discount the fact this book was written to God's people. And it is an ominous ending for them. Because Ezekiel is going to tell them, you did this, 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 this. God told you not to. He told you not to. He told you not to. And he told you not to again. And now he's done. And I'm going to tell you, like Ezekiel says, you are finished. You will be revived in the millennium. But there are going to be some tough centuries for you guys. Because you're out of the promised land never to return. They have never returned to the promised land as people. I'm not talking the 1948 thing. That's not the promised land. That's a little tiny hunk of piece of ground. That's not the promised land. Look how big the promised land was. Look what Canaan looked like. They've never returned to that. And this is Ezekiel telling them, God took you out because you deserved it. And he warns them, and this is beyond warning. This is just stamping it done. Now, we haven't seen this type of eschatology appear yet. And what he's going to really focus on is he's going to take you in a really tough place, and then he's going to take you into the millennium. He's going to do like a lot of prophecies and take you really hard. He's going to thump really hard, and then he's going to give them the glimpse. But in the millennium. But there will come a day when you will walk into the golden city with the Messiah and you will reign with him. And it's a promise. It's hundreds of years down the road. And yet there is that glimmer of hope. He is the first apocalyptic prophet as far as actually being rivaled with John. He's even a lot more than Daniel. You'll find that as you read. He has a world of four-headed beasts. He has a world of strange other things. He is going to write like a priest because that's how he was trained. And yet he's going to speak like a prophet. Love that. He's going to really hit him on ritual uncleanness because he would know that. And he's going to criticize. And he's going to chide. And he's going to be hard. And yet he's going to give you a peek about the eternal God that we don't see from anybody else. He is 65 different times. In his unique way, he's going to voice God saying, I am God and I am sovereign. In other words, I do what I do because I'm God. And he's going to say that theme in this book 65 times. In 48 chapters, that'll give you some idea how much he's going to hone that in. And so he's the voice of God saying to these wayward people, I'm God. You want to ask why I'm doing this? Because I'm God. I think America would be wise. I think I point thumbs back at self. When we question God, we need to go back to Ezekiel and understand this is a sovereign God. Yes, he's love. Of course he is. He sent Jesus. But he's God, and he will not be mocked, and he will not be made a fool of, and he will not be disobeyed because he's God. And this particular, I view what you're going to see from Ezekiel is 65 different times. I think that's just huge. So the chronology, he makes this chronological order because he's the master journaler. Chapters 1 through 24, actually, he's going to warn about Jerusalem falling. He's going to just tell them over and over, and they're laughing at him, and they're saying, no, Jerusalem's fine. And then they get the runner that comes in and tells them it fell. Then his whole focus changes. So in chapters 25 to 32, then, it's fallen. He's going to quit warning him it's going to fall because it already fell. So in chapters 25 through 32, he's going to take on all the nations that surround him, that surround Israel, and he's going to pick them off one at a time, and he's going to see what's going to happen to them because they were against Israel. And he's going to name names, and he's going to lay really heavy duty on them. And that's chapters 25 through 32. Then chronologically, because we're staying in that rigid order that he follows, 33 through 48, he's going to talk about the hope and the restoration of the people. And you may think he's telling it for after the 70 years of captivity, but he's going beyond that. Yeah, he hints at that too, but he's going way beyond. He's going to take them clear into the millennium where they're priests with their King of Kings. He's going to talk about the Messiah. You want to know how Jesus in the Old Testament, he's all over Ezekiel. Let me tell you a hint about him. He refers to himself sometimes as Son of Man. And I'm going to tell you this truth, and you may know this, but I'm going to say it just for those that don't. Jesus more often referred to his own self as Son of Man. The humanness of Jesus was what took him to the cross. The deity is what made him create the whole earth. The humanness is what brought him to the cross. He had to become human. He had to become flesh and dwell among us so that he would be sacrificed. Ezekiel will call himself the Son of Man. You're going to see a hint of a picture of Jesus in Ezekiel. He's going to sacrifice. He's going to lay his life down. He's going to give up friends. His wife dies, and he's going to weep with the people. You're going to see the Son of Man get a glimpse of who Jesus was, too. I love that. Let me tell you what we know for sure starting out, and we'll add to that as we go. The meaning of his name, and it means the strength of God. We know he was born in 627 B.C. We know that because we back-figured from when he was 25 years old. He would have been born in the time of King Josiah. He was a priest. We know that. He was taken captive with King Jehoiachin, or Kim, whichever you pronounce it, in 597 B.C. That king lasts about 11 years, and he's actually taken captive in this second siege. So that king, quote, quote, is in this same group that Ezekiel knows him. He's not a good one either. He was in Chebar. That's that, remember I told you, that's Tel Aviv. That's that reservoir area where most of the captives were taken. It's a royal canal that Nebuchadnezzar used. And he was married and had his own home. His wife died during his ministry, and God commanded him not to remarry. He also commanded him not to weep or mourn her. And if you want to know a real coincidence, and there is no such thing in God's language, his wife died on the exact same day that Jerusalem fell. That's a real picture we're going to get when we study that. And that we'll find that in the 24th chapter of Ezekiel. He served with contemporaries of Jeremiah and Daniel. Now, we don't know that he actually saw them. He does mention Daniel three times, although we don't know that he knew him or just was getting writing from him. He prophesied at least 20 years. He dates beginning and ending, closer to 22 years. He mentions his main heroes, and you're going to think they're funny because Daniel, of course. And then he mentions Job. He also mentions Noah, and he names them. We know that he has familiarity with Jeremiah. Some people think that maybe he saw him. We were saying, captive. We don't know that. That's just a hint. He was in the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiachin. And his last discourse, he dates. We don't know if he died then or if he just stopped prophesying. Don't know that. He never mentions the release of Jehoiachin. That's not even part of his vocabulary, although he would have known that. We go a little bit back in history. King Josiah brought a spiritual revival into Judah. He was a good king. He messed up. And when you mess up, there's a big price to pay. He decided Pharaoh Necho was coming down from the north to fight with Assyria. And it was not Josiah's battle. But Josiah, he decided he was going to get into it. And he went north to battle Pharaoh Necho. And I don't know why. And he got killed. And when he did, it was a landslide of bad kings after that. We find that probably, if you date the dates right, probably baby Ezekiel was born in that time of King Josiah's reign. And then he probably grew up in lots of bad kings. That's just the speculation of doing the dating on this. All that's history, but I think it serves you well to know who this man is. And if you're interested in that historical, you can look that up because it's well documented with the Assyrians and all and the dates. So, Jehoiakim then was a king that was not good. He actually served 11 years, but he was taken in the second season. I already told you that. And then he dies, and his son, which is worse, lasts 3 months. That tells you kind of the idea of these people. But God gives Ezekiel a really dire message, and he's not going to give me any roses and perfume for this guy. And what was happening, which is happening today, he was trying to tell the people how to get their act straightened up and what they'd done wrong. And there were false prophets all around saying, oh, it's not true. We're soon going to be out of here. Egypt is battling with the Chaldeans, and they're going to rescue us. And Jerusalem's still standing. And don't believe mean old Ezekiel. He's just lying. Him and that Jeremiah, they're just liars. Just live your life and be happy. And Ezekiel's saying, it's not going to be like that. Jerusalem's going to fall, and you all are going to die if you don't stop this. And then Jerusalem falls. And then his wife dies. And his life turns upside down. And we'll see. We'll watch his writing change when that happens, because this is in perfect chronological order. It's placed in the canon, this book, and the Hebrew canon is placed following Isaiah and Jeremiah among the major prophets. You do know that I don't like the term major and minor prophets. Minor prophets are called simply because of their length. We've loved those minor prophets. They were just shorter books. This is a long book. So I believe after we've discussed this here, there's some purposes for this book. You can add your list as we go through this. He wanted to speak to the exiles because he's one of them. And he addresses them and he wants them to change and let them know why they're there. He wants to outline that God is a God. He'd like to give blessings. He gave us the promised land. He has to take it away. God is just. God is sovereign. Remember, 65 times he's going to tell them that. But he's also going to tell them that he will bring judgment, but he'll also bring restoration. And he is calling himself a watchman of the imminent judgment that will happen. I wonder how many of us sense that for America. Then we see some parables. We think of Jesus telling parables. This is Ezekiel. He uses a parable of a wild vine, of a deserted baby girl, of two sisters, of a lioness and her cubs, of eagles. He is trying to get him past this horrible stage and to get him to the final restoration of the millennium. He uses types and shadows, and you're going to see this Son of Man that he refers himself to often. We're going to lay him as a parallel to a picture of the coming Messiah that's also called the Son of Man. The word God appears in this book more than in any other book in the Bible. 434 times. It's Yahweh, and sometimes it's doubled up, Adonai Yahweh. And the doubling up appears 66 times. I think you're going to understand the import of that. Jeremiah uses the same 82 times. So he's like five times more than Jeremiah talking about God. If you want to know what the theme of Ezekiel is, it's God. So I think that gives you enough of a brief. As we do this every week, I'll add more interesting. That's probably more facts than you wanted to know. But maybe it puts you in the right historic perspective to who this guy is and why we are going to study him. I'm in Ezekiel 1:1. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the 4th month, on the 5th day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river Chebar, that the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. Please know he's not asleep. It's not a dream, it's a vision. Reminds you of John, doesn't it? Seeing those. The 30th year, that's interesting, and I want you to pick that apart. What does 30th year mean? It means he had turned 30. That's his 30th year. It's not the 30th year they're in captive. It's his birthday. It's important to him because he was supposed to be a priest. He doesn't get to, God calls him. The day of his 30th year, God gives him this vision. It will also remind you of some other people we know. So if Ezekiel were 30 years old in 593, he would have been born about 622 during the reign of good King Josiah. About 600, when he was some 23 years of age, the prophet got married. With his wife, he went to Babylon as an exile in 597 at the age of 26. And then the last dated prophecy of this book is in the year 571, when he would have been 56. So we're going to see a span of about age 26 to about 56. We're going to see about 30 years of his life, and he's going to detail. I like that when we know those exact dates. Let me give you some historical dates to follow with that. In 701 B.C., I'm going to take you on down a memory lane. Sennacherib decided he was going to come and take Jerusalem. If you'll remember, Hezekiah and Isaiah prayed, and God, Jesus Christ, Son of Man, God's mighty angel, the angel of God, went into Sennacherib's camp that night and killed 185,000 Assyrians, and Sennacherib and turned tail and went home and got killed by his two sons. 701. Fast forward about 100 years, 605 is Daniel taken captive. 597, Ezekiel's taken captive. 586, the last exile, Jerusalem falls. And in 539 BC, Babylon's defeated by Persia. And you'll know this by name. How about King Cyrus begins? So that puts you in perspective of how that came down the chain. I like to do that. The visions of God. The heavens were open and I saw visions of God. You're going to take a little look here, and I'm going to bring this up now, and then we'll talk about it more. And I want you to take a note of 1 Chronicles 28, and I'm in verse 16. And by weight he gave gold for the tables of showbread for each table, and silver for the tables of silver, also pure gold for the forks, the basins, the pitchers, of pure gold, and the golden bowls. He gave gold by weight for every bowl, and for the silver bowls, silver by the weight of every bowl, and refined gold by weight for the altar of incense, and for the construction of the, underline, chariot. That is the gold cherubim that spread their wings and overshadowed the ark of the covenant of the Lord. Did you know God has a chariot? I just read it to you. I'm a literalist. Go back and reread it. This is a description of the altar of God in heaven. God has a chariot. I'm going on with that. I want to make a point here. Psalm 68:17. The chariots, plural, of God are myriads. Myriads means millions, thousands upon thousands. The Lord is among them as at Sinai in holiness. Not my words, but King David's. Continue on in Psalm 68:33. To him who rides upon the highest heavens, which are from the ancient times, behold, he speaks forth with his voice, a mighty voice. God's riding around on something, according to David. I think the chronicler said it was a chariot. Isaiah 66:15. For behold, the Lord will come in a fire, and his chariots like whirlwind, to render his anger with fury, and his rebuke with flames of fire. Have I began to tell you that God has chariots? Did I say that? I think I've had enough. I could probably find you a few more instances of that, but I want you to keep that in your mind as we begin getting this vision. God has chariots, plural, myriads, it was said. I'm in Ezekiel 1:2. On the 5th day of the month, which was in the fifth year of King Jehoiachin's captivity. The word of the Lord came expressly. That means no one else got this word but Ezekiel. To Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, the land of the Chaldeans by the river Chebar. And the land of the Lord, sorry, the hand of the Lord was upon him there. Okay, a couple things. This is only for Ezekiel. No one else saw this vision but him. We know where he's at. He's told us that. We know who he is. He's identified himself, and he's going to document what he saw. First of all, the hand of the Lord. Isaiah 25:10, for on this mountain the hand of the Lord will rest, and Moab shall be trampled down under him, as straw is trampled down for the refuge heap. Isaiah 41:10, fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Yes, I will help you. I love this verse. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Did you think God didn't have hands? We are made in his image. He's got feet too. He's got a head. He's got eyes. Of course he's God, but we are made in his image. So this is what Ezekiel's seeing. He's going to see God. And there's some really good descriptions here. When we talk about why he was put where he was, I did some research on that land of Chebar. It was the principal colony. They had made it, I don't know whether it's an encampment or tent city or whatever, but it was where most of the exiles lived. The first ones that went, Daniel, all those, they all went to the royal court, but there was a smaller group of them. When they began taking the second and the third groups, there was thousands, and they put them by this. Number one, water was an issue. I mean, they didn't have indoor plumbing. They had to have water. And so they camped him about this big reservoir that Nebuchadnezzar had built. And that's where he's at. He's at Chebar, Tel Aviv today. Now, from now on, this is going to begin descriptions of what might be the most unusual and detailed vision of God. We're going to get a picture of God. We saw it with Isaiah. John talked about it a little bit. But this is the most detailed picture. You want to know what God looks like, you need to read Ezekiel. And we're getting ready to go into that. And we're also going to find that this particular prophet is going to spend more time than any other prophet in the book telling how he was called. This was a big deal to him because he thought he was going to be a priest. So this is a huge deal to him. I am in verse 4, fasten your seatbelts. And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind was coming out of the north, a great cloud with raging fire engulfing itself, and brightness was all around it, and radiating out of its midst like the color of amber out of the midst of fire. North usually means judgment. We also know north for God, because he's more dimensional than we are, usually means up. I could take you into 100 verses where he's talking north, he's talking up. He's in multi-dimensions. We're in this little tiny 3-4-dimension sphere. Usually means up, usually means judgment. And usually, because he's coming from the north, we're going to be pointing to God's throne in this. Okay? I'm going to go take you to Exodus here for a minute. People had images of God other than Ezekiel. In Exodus 13, verse 21, and the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light so as to go by day and night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from beyond the people. Exodus 3, 2, and the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire in the midst of the bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, and the bush was not consumed. Cloud by day, fire by night was expressions of God's presence with Israel. Raging fire, you're going to see God always portrayed around fire. Our God is a consuming fire, according to Hebrews 12:29. For our God is a consuming fire. 1 John 1:5. God is light is the message which we have heard from him and declare to you, that God is light and in him is no darkness at all. Fire and light. And this is what Ezekiel's seeing. I'm continuing on Ezekiel 1:5. Also from within came the likeness of four living creatures. This was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. Each one had four faces. Each one had four wings. Their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the soles of calf's feet. They had cloven hoofs, in other words, split hoofs. They sparkled like the color of burnished bronze. The hands of the man were under the wings on their four sides, and each of the four had faces and wings. Their wings touched one another. The creatures did not turn when they went, but each one went straight forward. If you could describe those, you probably couldn't. You would want to say, I'm going to tell you the easiest way. They are an angelic being. They're not beasts. We do know that God created lots and lots of things before he created us. There were sons of God cheering when God created the heavens and earth. And they were standing around by the millions when he created the first man. So I think it's going to be a real slideshow for us when we get there to see all the neat stuff he created. And I just want to pick this apart a little bit. Are they cherubim? Probably. They probably are. Let me talk about the cherubim. The cherubim was important to God because he had his altars and the tabernacle decorated with it. Exodus 25:18. And you shall make two cherubim of gold of hammered work. You shall make them at the two ends of the mercy seat. Make one cherub at one end and the other cherub at the other end. You shall make the cherubim at the two ends of it of one piece with the mercy seat. He goes into great details about their wings and what they look like. These are the only angelic creatures, the cherubim, these creatures that we get the reference of wings. When we see Gabriel, when we see Michael, we don't see wings. These are specific kind of angelic being that has wings. They're called cherubim. The Romanesque authors and artists who did the baby angels with little wings flying around, they look like little fat, cute, pink babies, and they called them cherubs. That's a way misnomer. These cherubs are not cute. In fact, if you didn't know they were God, you'd be kind of afraid. Can you imagine seeing this thing? But they're all over the Bible. 1 Samuel 4:4. So the people went to Shiloh that they might from there bring their ark of the covenant of the Lord of hosts who dwells between the cherubim. The glory, the Shekinah glory of God dwelled between those cherubim setting over the Ark of the Covenant. I don't know why, but we get that picture of those cherubim and the Shekinah glory of God between them all over the Bible. Psalm 81, give ear, O shepherd of Israel, you who lead Joseph like a flock, you who dwell between the cherubim. By the way, cherubim, B-I-M, it's plural. A cherub is one. When the Hebrew takes an I-M ending, it's plural. He dwells between the cherubim. Isaiah 37:16, O Lord of hosts, God of Israel, the one who dwells between the cherubim. Lots of references. Let me tell you what Hebrews, let's see what Paul says. Hebrews 8:4. For if he were on earth, he would not be a priest, since there are priests who offer the gifts according to the law, who serve the copy and shadow of the heavenly things, as Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle. For he said, see that you make all things according to this pattern shown on the mountain. God is into details. He gave specific details of how to make that tabernacle, how to make that Ark of the Covenant, how to make the coverings and everything. And I don't know why, but it's important to him. And part of it is because he wanted to dwell, the Shekinah glory needed to dwell between those cherubim. Ezekiel's beginning to see what these look like up close and personal. And he not only sees their big wings, he sees that they're surrounded by these wheels within a wheel that have eyes all over. And he's got to be saying, God, what am I seeing? He's got to be saying that. We're going to go further with that. So the designs of the cherubim were all over the tabernacle. And that was a very, very important. Now, I want to compare what he just saw, those four-faced living creatures, with what John saw in Revelation 4. The four creatures that John saw, I want to read to you, and I'm in it, Revelation 4:6. Note the similarity. They're seeing the same thing. Remember, there's going to be a little difference in language, and I'm going to tell you why. Almost 600 years is the difference between the Ezekiel writing and John's, and the language has changed a little bit. So what they've seen and their purpose of focus has changed. I mean, John has seen more. Things have changed more on the earth, so it's not going to be quite the same, but look at the parallel here, and I'm in Revelation 4:6. Before the throne, John seeing this same thing, the throne of God, was a sea of glass like crystal, And in the midst of the throne and around the throne were four living creatures. Does this sound the same to you? Full of eyes in the front and the back. The first living creature was like a lion. The second living creature was like a calf. The third living creature had the face of a man. And the fourth like a flying eagle. They're the same faces. Just seeing the same. The words are different. People say it's not exactly the same. There's 600 years has passed. These guys are looking at these from a little bit different eyes. But trying, like, you think your mother and dad or your great-grandmother could look at your iPad and explain what it was? They would be mystified to look at that and even explain it. And then you would explain it in different language, seeing the same thing. That's what my point is. Isaiah saw a vision of God in Isaiah 6. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne. Remember that? High and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above it stood seraphim. Now, he calls them seraphim. I believe they're really cherubim. I believe those two terms are interchangeable. The closest I could do in the Hebrew, they pretty much make them the same. Each one had six wings, and two he covered his face, and two he covered his feet, and the two he flew, and one cried to the other, "Holy, holy, holy." I think what we're seeing is a glimpse of around the throne, God has living creatures. Don't look like us, but they've got some real neat facial features. Ezekiel says they're not men. He said they had the likeness of men. That, think about his words. He's trying to explain these. They were angelic beings. They were of the spirit world that God lives in. And so it would be very hard for him to explain that. He uses that word likeness at least 10 times because he has no other words except likeness. It looks like. It reminds me like. And he says their appearance, when he can't explain it, he uses that term 14 times. He's struggling to explain what he sees. Now, these cherubim are such important entities that we're going to find out that they're going to appear throughout Scripture, usually in the apocalyptic kind of writings. The feet were interesting, too. They were bronze, if you remember. Let me tell you where else we saw that. So you know we're looking at the same thing. I'm in Revelation 1:15. This is a description of Jesus. His feet were like fine brass, as if it had been refined in a furnace. And his voice, get this, as the sound of many waters. I'm going to intimate to you, and you can take this for what it's worth. I believe he's catching a glimpse of the pre-incarnate Christ. I think he's going to look past the wheel within a wheel and the creatures that are surrounding the throne. He's going to look up to that throne that is glazed over like azure. And he's going to look up to that throne and he sees and he calls him like a man. What did Jesus call himself? The Son of Man. And I believe that fire that's coming out of him, the feet like burnished brass that John saw. And John didn't know hardly who he was either. And I believe he's catching a glimpse of Jesus Christ sitting on his Father's throne because he's not on his own throne yet. Jesus is not on his throne yet, and he won't be till he comes back in Revelation 19 on that big white war horse. He captures his, and goes into Petra, and he captures his remnant, and he takes over the whole earth, and then he marches into the millennium with his people and us by his side, and he takes over his throne. Right now, who's sitting on the Father's throne? It's Jesus, the Son of Man. And as Ezekiel begins to describe this, he says he's like a man. That man ought to be a real clue for you guys, because that's what Jesus called himself. I'm in Ezekiel 1, verse 10. As for the likeness of their faces, each had a face of a man. Each of the four had the face of a lion on their right side. Each of the four had the face of an ox on the left side. And each of the four had the face of an eagle. Thus were their faces. Their wings stretched upward, two wings of each, one touched one another, and two covered their bodies. Boy, does this just sound like something else we just read. And each one went straight forward. They went wherever the Spirit wanted to go, and they did not turn when they went. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, like the appearance of torches going back and forth among the living creatures. The fire was bright, and out of the fire went lightning, and the living creatures ran back and forth in appearance like a flash of lightning. Let me tell you several things. I think this means 100 things. I'm going to touch on a few of them. There are scholars that believe those four faces. I believe they're literal. I think they look just like that. But they might mean some other things. Let me tell you what they might mean. Many authors think that compares to the four Gospels, and here's how they got that. Because the ox was always a beast of servanthood, served as a beast of burden, and was always a servant, they believe that's like Mark, who was a great servant for the Lord God, Jesus Christ. They believe the lion points to the royalty of Christ. He's called the Lion of Judah, of course, but lions are royalty. Matthew spoke often of this king that was coming, this king that had come, king of the Jews. Now, you're going to love this, and especially Tristan will. The man's face, the humanity, the Son of Man, the side of the face that looked like a man would be Luke. Dr. Luke spoke to the humanity of Christ. He took the bloodline when he did his lineage back to his mother. Because as a physician, he understood that he had no father earthly. And so he took his lineage. You remember we studied that? And Dr. Luke looked at the humanity. So that man's face would remind you of Luke. And John always spoke of his majesty. If you remember John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And so that eagle, that majestic bird, that would be John. Now, I like that. Don't know, but that might be just really good. Let me tell you another interesting thing. If you go to Numbers, when the Israelites camped around the tabernacle, they camped by standard or flag. They camped in specific places, and it was laid out. And when you look down, if you could have looked down on the camp of Israel, they were in the shape of a cross with the tabernacle in the center. It was really cool. But let me tell you what this might mean. It might be pointing specifically these faces, and I'm going to take you way far on this one. So hold on to your hat here, and you can just go, whoa. Give me this, if that was really true, and I know it is, that they camped according to their standards, okay? Let me tell you how they camped, just so you know. On the north, Dan and his group camped. I know this from Numbers. You can read all this if you want to. But Dan camped on the north. His standard was an eagle, okay? I didn't make this up. This is all in Numbers. Standard mean their flag that they put up, and they camped around it. On the south, Reuben camped. His flag was a man, okay? On the east was Judah, lion, the Lion of Judah. And on the west was Ephraim, and he was an ox. The four standards that stood up in the wilderness around the tabernacle were, guess what? Man, eagle, ox, and lion. You see any similarities here? And this was the whole tribe of Israel, all of them, as they camped. Now, let me walk you with this. If that's true, and it is, and those four animals represent all of Israel, which they do in camping around the tabernacle, and if Israel has always been surrounded by enemies on all of her sides that are watching them, ready to attack on both perimeters, all around. Let's go one step further in this mystery and say, could what we really see, these figures could also represent God knowing that Israel, this four-faced being, could represent Israel, and the wheels that are around it are her enemies that have eyes that are trying always to surround her. Could it be even that deep? Could it be that it's all those things? Could it? I think they're literally creatures that sat before God. I do believe that. I think John saw him and Daniel saw him and now Ezekiel saw him. But I think it's representing a lot more. I think their appearance reminds us that God understands that Israel, those four faces that camped about the ark, that are his people, are surrounded by enemies on all sides. And wherever they go, Wherever Israel goes, those enemies go. Wherever Israel goes to one side, they go. And I think we are looking at the struggle that has been forever for Israel. And I know that's way out there. But I think it's way more than just seeing the creatures around the throne. God is so deep. And maybe you can't go that far. Think about it. See if that makes sense to you. Eyes usually mean that something is not good. If they're watching like that, they're watching for trouble. They're watching. And this tells us that those wheels within the wheels are always encircling Israel. Okay?
They would be bad.
Yes. And I do believe these are creatures that surround God's throne. I think literally they do. But I think they're it's way deeper than that. Now, let me tell you one other thing it also could mean. And I love this. There are four different animal species represented here. You've got the birds. Well, the eagle. I mean, you've got the birds. You've got the wild animals like lions. And, you know, I'd say like safari animals. Okay, that's the lion. Then you've got the domestic animal. There's the ox, right? And then you've got, I've got one other one. You've got the eagle, the man, the lion, and the ox. And you've got the man. Okay. What animal species is not mentioned there? There's no reptiles. And do you know that because Satan is called the old dragon, the lizard, the serpent, he was called that and he was kicked out of the kingdom. That particular animal group is not represented in these creatures that sit around God's throne. There are no reptiles. Do you love that? The specificity of God in dealing with the minute details just blows my mind away. And so I've made a lot out of these four creatures. I think you can think about them however you want to. I think they're literally sitting there. I think you see King Jesus on the throne. And I think there's no doubt about it that Ezekiel is seeing exactly what John saw, exactly what Daniel saw. God doesn't change. Now, remember, the way they express it, their centuries have passed, so maybe their language is a little bit different. Like I use the expression about your grandma explaining your iPad. When you see exactly the same thing, that's what I think you're seeing there. So think about those creatures and see if that makes sense. And maybe that will make you begin to understand that once Ezekiel sees this vision, it changes his life. We know that he never is the same again. Who would be? Who would be? I'm in the 15th verse of Ezekiel 1. Now I looked at the living creatures. Behold, a wheel was on the earth beside each living creature with its four faces. The appearance of the wheels and their workings was like the color of beryl, and all four had the same likeness. The appearance of their workings was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. When they moved, they went toward any one of four directions. They did not turn aside when they went. As for their rims, they were so high they were awesome. Their rims were full of eyes all around all four of them. When the living creatures went, the wheels went beside them. And when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. Whenever the spirit wanted to go, they went, because there the spirit went. And the wheels were lifted together with them, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. When they rose, these went. When they stood, these stood. And when those were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up together with them, for the spirit of the living creature was in the wheels. And I think we've explained those pretty well. You can go into more detail if you want to on those. I want to give you a new word, just so you'll be a real linguist. Let me tell you. I talked to you a little bit about God being in a chariot. I'm going to refer to Ezekiel 1:26. Ezekiel saw a throne chariot, a supernatural chariot, giving the effect of great motion and irresistible progress. And the rabbis had a word for that. It's Merkabah, M-E-R-K-A-B-H-A-H, Merkabah. I'm really butchering that. And it means, and they know exactly what it means. It means the divine throne chariot. Ezekiel's going to go, he's going to go into great detail about that. King David hinted at it. We've got lots of verses about God riding on the clouds. And the rabbis called it a Merkabah. a wheel in the middle of a wheel, God's chariot. When they moved, they went toward any one of four directions. Daniel 7:9, I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow. The hair of his head was pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame. They're talking about his throne. Now listen to what Daniel says. And we read this over and we don't pay attention. Its wheels, a burning fire. His throne has wheels. Can we say chariot? Merkabah. 1 Kings 7:27. He also made 10 carts of bronze. 4 cubits was the length of each cart, 4 cubits its width, and 3 cubits its height. And this was the design of the carts. They had panels, and the panels were between frames. On the panels were between the frames were lions, oxen, and cherubim. This is God's artwork when he has something done. And these supported the bases of Solomon's temple. These cherubim, these four faces, is a recurring theme we're going to see over and over again. And we don't want to discount that many people see God's throne with wheels. The Merkaha, God's chariot. 1 Chronicles 28:18. Refined gold by weight for the altar of the incense. And this is the one I read you before, but I love it. And for the construction of the chariot. I love that. That is the gold cherubim that spread their wings. So, just saying. Proverbs 15:3. We're talking about the eyes surrounding. Very, very prominent symbolism in the Bible. Proverbs 15:3. The eyes of the Lord are in every place, keeping watch on the evil and good. Revelation 4:6. The wheels symbolize the omnipresence of God. Because Revelation 4:6 says this, before the throne was a sea of glass like crystal, and in the midst of the throne and around the throne were four living creatures. I believe we're seeing that same picture there. The Shekinah glory, we're gonna see leave the temple. And later on when we study that, we'll talk more about that. We've hinted at that here. And I'm in 22 verse Ezekiel 1. The likeness of the firmament of the heads of the living creatures was like the color of an awesome crystal, stretched out over their heads, and under the firmament their wings spread out straight, one toward another. Each one had two which covered one side. Each one had two which covered the other side of the body. When they went, I heard the noise of their wings, like the noise of many waters. That always sounds like God. That's many references to that. Each one had two which covered one side, and each one had two which covered the other side. When they went, I heard the noise of their wings, like the noise of many waters, like the voice of the Almighty. Like the voice of the Almighty. Like it. Remember, this is the 65 times he's saying this. A tumult like the noise of an army. When they stood still, they let down their wings. A voice came from above the firmament that was over their heads. Whenever they stood, they let down their wings. So they're underneath this chariot throne thing that Jesus is sitting on. They're protecting him. They're watching. They're a symbol of Israel. They're all kinds of things. They're the symbol of the flags that were put up in the wilderness. They're the symbol of his animal kingdom. They're the symbol of the gospels. They are many things because that's how God is multidimensional. The firmament, of course, was above. We know that. When they heard the noise. Revelation 1:15. His feet were like fine brass as if refined in a furnace. And his voice. This will clue you in on who this was. John says his voice as the sound of many waters. It is the exact same expression Ezekiel uses. John is describing Jesus. He uses the same terms as Ezekiel. His voice is like many waters. You're looking at King Jesus. You're looking at a theophany. King Jesus in the Old Testament. That's what you're looking at. I'm in the 26th verse. And above the firmament over their heads was the likeness of a throne. In appearance like sapphire stone, on the likeness of the throne was a likeness. Get this. With the appearance of a man. That man is a clue word. High above it. And from the appearance of his waist and upward I saw as it were the color of amber. With the appearance of fire all around within it. And from the appearance of his waist and down, I saw as it were the appearance of fire with brightness all around. This is Jesus. Like the appearances of a rainbow in a cloud on a rainy day, so was the appearance of the brightness all around. This was the appearance of the likeness And here's his clue of the glory of the Lord. The Shekinah glory was on this man. Who would this man be? Who do you think has the Shekinah glory on him? I'm thinking King Jesus. So when I saw it, I fell on my face and I heard a voice of one speaking. Daniel fell on his face when he saw his vision too. This is not unlike someone to do that. So we're talking about God's throne. We're talking this theophany is Jesus. Now this is my summation. You don't have to agree with me. You can pick these verses apart yourself and you can come up with a different idea. This is what I've gleaned from this. If God is going to be portrayed in a concrete form, the highest symbol man could use is the human form because we are in his likeness. When God wanted to reveal himself in the supreme revelation to his people, he did so in the form of a man, and his name was Jesus. He referred to himself as Son of Man. That is a huge clue word. The color of amber is, and we're going to see lots of colors, amber, emerald green, sapphire blue, glowing metal. All these always point to the throne. The likeness of the glory of the Lord. This was the man, Jesus Christ, and this is the last and best part of the vision. Christ was set by his Father in the upper part of the celestial realms on his throne. This is King Jesus. So we've talked about the Shekinah glory. We've talked about what you've seen. I hope by now maybe you get a little bit better picture of what this vision means. It means 100 things. And if I told you 100, there'd be 1,000 more. Because that's how the Bible is. I picked out 4 or 5 symbolisms of what those creatures in that vision look like. And you can pick out more. Just dig. I hope it tweaks your curiosity enough that you begin to see the depth and the height and the width of the beauty of the Word of God and how rich it truly is. If Ezekiel didn't know it before, now he clearly understands that the glory of God is not restricted to Jerusalem and that Solomon's temple that he knew. It's not restricted to that. There is no doubt that through his ministry, whether Ezekiel listened to the voice or spoke the messages said to him, he did so in the consciousness of what he sees in this very first story of the glory of Jehovah as he has seen with his very own eyes. It changes his life, and his writing will never be the same. And there's some promises inherent with this. Ezekiel 1:10, as for the likeness of their faces, each had the face of a man, and each of the four had the face of a lion on the right side. Each of the four had the face of an ox on the left side. Each of the four had the face of an eagle. And that means 100 things and more. And I'm going to take you way far in Ezekiel, almost to the end. Ezekiel 36:26. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you. I will take the heart of stone out of your flesh and give you heart of flesh. That's your promise. Father, I thank you for Ezekiel. Thank you for the promise and the glory of this beautiful word. Let us not mistake one thing that you want us to know, and let us be changed because of your beauty and your wonder and your Shekinah glory. We love you in Jesus' name. Amen.